that was, if anything goes wrong with the holding operation, the tower section that's being installed cannot drop anything more than the 6 feet of that lanyard, and the lanyard itself is 5,000 pound test nylon. I did that because I want to stay alive. When you're constructing a tower, anything more than, in my opinion, 50, 7,500 feet, when you're doing that, if you don't have some kind of an auxiliary safety device to make sure that a tower section cannot drop, then you're at considerable risk that most people do not anticipate. I've seen multiple movies of that exact scenario, or scenarios like that, with towers coming down at ridiculously high rates, people on the tower, and you're watching a photograph of them dying violently. The accident that I remember hearing around that time was that the top tower section was being installed. In order to save time, the tower erecting crew decided to install the antenna on top of that tower section. So they're holding up a tower section with the broadcast antenna on the top of it. And the foreman apparently went into a local hardware store, bought some shackles that had not been pull tested, that were not really rated for the service they were about to be used in. And halfway, three quarters of the way up to the actual altitude, the shackle let loose, the tower section with the antenna on it dropped, cut through lower guy wires, and everybody on the tower and one or two people on the ground died. So a very common scenario. Why in the world OSHA doesn't create some very specific rules in this case is amazing to me. I've watched towers being erected with towers that have guy wire support. I've watched them being put together, and I see a number of things that could easily create an accident that no one anticipates, no one applies any corrective action for it. So, no, I haven't seen that exact program last week, but I'm glad you brought it to our attention, Steve. And so we amateurs who are going to be constructing towers in the future, whether it be at a field day site or whether it be the new ethereal adornment that's going into your backyard with all those fancy antlers on the top of it, something to definitely consider. Gravity will get you down. And so the thing to worry about most when you're on a tower, you think that everything that you drop is going to fall away from you. Well, if you drop something heavy, it can create an awful lot of damage to the people below you, and under the worst-case situation, it can damage the tower that's below you that's holding you up. Guarantee it will get to your attention. Thank you for that information, Steve. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Yeah, I've seen this, and I was totally amazed. I mean, they show that tower once it was on the ground. It literally looked like a bowl of spaghetti. It was just a mass, a twisted wreckage. It was totally amazing. I've seen pictures on the Internet. Someone pointed me to a couple of Internet sites about this. But seeing it, you know, as an actual, you know, like amateur movie, it was quite scary. It gave you something to think about. Back to you.
Yeah, there was another set of movies that I saw about 6 months or so ago. I think somebody gave it to me from a website, and if I do a little bit of searching, I'll find it. Now, the scenario of this particular movie is where there were two towers side by side, and for reasons I don't quite understand, one of the towers was being abandoned. And so to disassemble that tower by the conventional technique would have been very time-consuming and expensive. A decision was made that they would cut down the tower that was being abandoned and continue to use the one that was very nearby. Well, when they cut the guy wires on the tower that was being abandoned, those guy wires sprung back, spiraled, and they spiraled around the guy wires of the standing tower. So as the abandoned tower started descending, the guy wires that were tangled together experienced sudden tensioning and whiplashing, and it created a failure of the tower that they intended to continue using. So the net result was both towers came descending to the ground. Both of them were more than 1,000-foot structures. Along the same lines, a buddy of mine who lives in Texas, lives in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, has mailed me pictures of what it's like with his camcorder riding in the elevator that goes to the top of an 1,800-foot tower, that's near him in Texas, where some ham radio equipment was installed at various altitudes on that tower. It was a commercial broadcast tower. And what the world looks like from 1,800 feet when you're on one of these towers is really something else. The portion of Texas he was in is rather flat, but from the top of that tower, I'm quite sure when you look out to the horizon in that movie, you do see the curvature of the Earth. So, to my knowledge, the tallest tower on planet Earth that ever was erected, tallest structure ever erected by mankind, was the 2,153-foot tower that used to be in Płock, Poland. Radio 1 of Poland for many decades transmitted from that tower. The guy wires became rusty. The low bidder won the job to replace the guy wires. That low bidder really wasn't sufficiently skilled in what he was doing. They disconnected too many guy wires at the same time, and the structure failed, and the people on it died. And so you would think that that broadcast station, which was very famous in Poland, would get permission to just simply put the tower back up. That's not what happened. The zoning board of that town said, we don't trust you guys anymore. You cannot reconstruct that tower in this town. And as such, they've been forced to use a tower in a much lower altitude in another town. Right now, the tallest structure that I know of is the one that's in North Dakota, very close to Grand Forks. And I believe it's 2,050 feet. It's a tri-state television transmitting tower. And it's not very far from the Grand Forks Air Force Base. And dignitaries who visit that Air Force Base are quite often taken into a plane ride where they drive the airplane, they fly the airplane near this tower. 2,050 feet, as I remember, is the altitude. And as I said, I think it's the tallest structure on Earth right now. And it's been there for at least 20 years or so, built into the side of a mountain. Massive structure. Tall towers are fun, one of my favorite subjects. Okay, the next person who signed in, let's see, who was that? I guess it was Aaron. Aaron, I think, said that he was only... we're going to give you an opportunity to talk, Aaron. Or was it WB2AAC? I'm going to give him a chance. His signal was very weak. Maybe he's done something to make a change, and maybe the propagation changed. WB2AAC, question mark. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Here is WB2AAP. Whiskey Bravo 2 Alpha Alpha Papa. The name is Vincent, and I'm just listening. Thank you.
Very fine, Vincent. That time we got you correctly. Alpha Alpha Papa. Alrighty. I know Paul signed in. Let's see if we have... Aaron, WC2C, did you have a question for us tonight? Quite possibly not. Also, I ran into Barry, into Mike Bravo, Moon Bounce, during the week. And if Barry has a chance, he's going to check in and discuss one of his favorite subjects. While we're waiting, let's find out what's the latest going on in space. So, Paul, WS2N, I think you're up at bat. You got it, Paul.
Okay, Dick, very good. Looking around the news reports, there's not much really new last couple of weeks. I was trying to figure out if the Hubble was going to be saved on a couple of websites with that, but no updates from the administrator on that. Mike Griffin. But the International Space Station is doing good. They just had another Progress ship arrive there and unload, I think, 6,000 pounds of water and fuel and food and different supplies that they need up there. And they had three spacecraft attached to the International Space Station at the same time, and not one of them is the shuttle. They had the Progress ship that just went up there. The old one is still attached. They didn't detach that yet. They usually do before the arrival of one, and then they burn up in the atmosphere with all the junk that's unnecessary, that they, you know, garbage and everything that they collect on the space station. But that was still attached. And then they also have the Soyuz spacecraft attached, which is their lifeboat. You know, that's what they, the last two guys came up in. And it has the capability of having three on board, and there are three on board the space station, so they use that as a lifeboat to get back. That's the rules. You can't have more people on the space station than you do have seats, than you have seats available for an emergency getaway. So when the shuttle goes up there and they have a, let's say, a crew of seven, and you'll see 10 people up there, that's okay, because then, you know, you have the shuttle plus the emergency Soyuz spacecraft to, you know, to leave. So it's all figured. There's not much new up there. The crew that's on board, they, you know, each group now stays up for, what, 6 months or so? So continuous presence in space, oh, since what, 2000, I guess. And before that, you had many years, what, 10, 15 years of the Mir spacecraft. Every day you look up, there's somebody up there. And in most cases, in the last 15, 20 years, there's a ham on board. Most of the astronauts that go off are hams. Many, many communications between the space station and even the old Mir when that was up there. So not much new, Dick. I've read a lot about the new crew exploration vehicle that's being built. Or, well, you know, they don't have any hardware yet, but it's being designed, and how that's all going to work out. I don't know if you ever want to hear about that. We're probably a little early, probably about 5-6 years away, I guess, before the first launch of one of those things. Back to you, Dick. K2RI WWS.
Very fine, Paul. I got two questions for you. Number one, what's your best guess as to how often a Progress ship goes up to the International Space Station and brings them consumable supplies? That's question number one. And question number two, can you make a rough guess as to how many pounds of material is brought up on each Progress ship, if you happen to know? Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, I believe it's 6,000 pounds. I used to know the percentages of water. Water is heavy. Oxygen, I think that the next heaviest thing. Of course, food. But roughly 6,000. Now, once they get the Jules Verne fired up, that's the one being built by the European Space Agency, that'll carry like four times the amount up to the space station. And I think that was supposed to go up this year, but that's been delayed to the end of the year. That was supposed to go up already in May. They're getting behind schedule. That's an automated vehicle. It'll be launched from South America, actually, from French Guiana, and that'll dock with the space station. There's a series of those things being built. And they got solar panels on it and all, you know, and it's also a satellite that'll do investigation work, or, you know, look back at the Earth and all. But the main purpose, of course, is to restock the space station. So I believe that's four times the amount of 6,000 pounds on that one. So the shuttle, of course, brings up a lot more on that one when it goes. And how many times a year? I think it's, what, once every 2 months, I think a Progress vehicle goes up. I think you're up to 25. So it's, what, 2000, and probably 2000, 2001, say 6 years. Yeah, 6, 12, 8, yeah, about four or five a year to go up, I think, Dick. Probably about 5 a year. Back to you, WS.
I guess the International Space Station is visited once or twice per year by the shuttle, which also brings up a good deal of hardware, consumables. So if it was nothing but Progress, once every 2 months, 6,000 pounds, That was 3,000 pounds per month. If I add the payload on the shuttle, bringing up on each one of its trips, I'll bet you I can come up with a number like 5,000 pounds per month of consumables are consumed. 5,000 pounds per month. Maybe it's 4,000 pounds per month. But it's in that ballpark. Now you see why I say that a human being, when you consider all of the oxygen, food, and water that he consumes in 1 year, it is approaching the weight of your house at the 4,000 pounds per month at 12 months. That's 480,000, half a million pounds. Half a million pounds of consumables per human being. Or maybe the two guys on board, so it's not quite that bad. But in rough order of magnitude, the weight of your house and the volume of your house in air, oxygen, water, and food is what a human being consumes. And that makes it extremely difficult to envision long-range manned missions, anything beyond the moon. A Mars mission, for instance, because of that limiting factor, is a very difficult mission to envision. Obviously, recycling is going to have to take place, and I mean serious recycling. When I say serious recycling, just envision what it would be like to recycle every molecule of gaseous material, fluid material, and solid material that is emitted by a human being in a day, a week, a month, a year. I mean, a mission to Mars is 2 years out, or I think it's more than a year on the way out, more than a year on the surface, and more than a year on the way back. So it's a 3 or 4 year mission to put enough consumables on board for each human being for that length of time. It's just out of the question. We're talking about something that is tens of times bigger than the spacecraft that's transporting the people. So somewhere along the lines, we're going to have to really get serious about recycling. The Earth does that for you. You could say, and good mathematicians have said, that when you take in a breath of air, the molecules of that air that are in your lungs were once inside of the lungs of every single human being that has ever lived beyond infant mortality on this planet. In other words, that caveman, 45,000 years ago, some of the air that was in his lungs is now in yours, because that air gets recycled. And you can make the exact same case for the water that you drink and the food that you eat. This Earth recycles everything for you. It takes us some time to do it. And we're going to have to, as astronauts and cosmonauts, we're going to have to learn to do that if any prolonged manned space mission is ever going to be envisioned. Each time I say that to a group of space-minded people, they think I'm being overly negative. I'm also amazed that I never read those words anywhere. How is everybody skipping over this? A significant percentage of our high school students are dreaming of the day when one of their equal-aged people, in other words, somebody in their generation, will be standing on the surface of Mars. They're dreaming about that. Exciting-sounding mission. But as you can see, there's some pretty serious problems to solve before we get there. I've been on that hobby horse before. Sorry about that, fellas. Mel? What's the latest over there in Manhattan Beach? I know that you're that group of guys out there in your particular amateur radio club are always doing things. So bring us up to date as to what they're doing, what you're suggesting that they do, and what you're doing. What's the latest in loop antennas? K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, everyone. This is K2KEY. Well, the only thing we have planned now for the next month, of course, is the preparation for field day. And we have to do a little bit of maneuvering our operation around at Floyd Bennett because they have made quite a number of changes on the base. The base has now been moralized, more or less somewhat commercialized. Tracks a lot of people down at Floyd Bennett now to see the Concorde, especially if you've never been able to get close to the Concorde, other than seeing it fly over your home. Would like to walk up and look at the Concorde. Of course, it's free of charge. It's sitting right there at Floyd Bennett. And also, we have to move our room of operation for field day to a new room because they turned our old room into a museum area. So we've got all these different little problems to iron out, but I'm sure we'll have a successful field day. As for myself, I've been somewhat busy, so I haven't, you know, pursued too much in the way of experiments further, other than what I was doing with both the full-wave loop outside and the inside the receiving loop. Still somewhat fascinated by it. I have yet to put any power into it, however, because the conditions on 80 needed are so that the fit outside with a full-wave loop, most of the time it takes even at least a kilowatt to make any kind of decent communication. Conditions are pretty marginal right now, and I guess it'll be that way for a while, especially as we move into the summer months ahead. As they say, insult to injury is because of the amount of thunderstorm activity in the United States, especially, down south. The QRN has been basically starting to increase every week. So 80 needs is a little bit of rough band to operate right now. But one of the few bands that are open at the evening, other than 160, 80, and some 40 meter activity. I got some emails, Dick, if you'd like to delve into some of the questions that I was able to pick out that I figured may be of interest to you, Nanette, and just in general, conversation of what people out there are problems they're having and ideas that they have, Dick, over.
Yeah, in the past, your emails were darn good questions by my standards. So fire away, Mel.
Okay, first one I got here from a gentleman that says that he saw advertised the CCD Charlie Charlie Dog dipole, and he'd like to know, does it really work? Is it really worth the investment, this dipole that this gentleman came up with, this broadband dipole? It's a full-wave dipole. And it's got a, before I get into the description of it in detail, I had to really research it out because I really tell you the truth, I wasn't that familiar with it. I had remembered in the back of my mind somewhere reading many years ago something about some kind of a departure and a dipole by doing some manipulation of the wire and adding things to it. And but I had to go back, really look back on it and get some background on it. How much are you familiar with CCD dipole, Dick? Over.
Okay, there's a kind of an antenna. I've suddenly forgotten the 3 or 4 letter abbreviation for it, which is a circular thing above a ground plane. It's parallel to the ground plane. It's a loop of wire, one wavelength long. Why in the world can I think of the... And it's not CCD. At least I don't think it is. I've forgotten the name of the darn thing. So go ahead and bring us up to speed on this one, Mel. Go ahead.
VDR.
Make a comment. I was just going to mention it, that the VDR type antennas were also around and basically a top-loaded loop. somebody want to make a comment about it before I go ahead?
Yeah, now remember. Thank goodness somebody reminded me. DDR stands for Directional Discontinuity Ring Radiator. DDRR, Directional Discontinuity Ring Radiator. Reasonably effective antenna. And there was a modified version of that where it was built like twin lead, and worked against itself as opposed to against a very large ground plane. Also, I guess the antennas we're talking about, Mel, are becoming worth considering and popular these days because we're sort of near the basement of the sunspot cycle. I don't know if the new sunspot cycle has begun yet, and as such, I guess we get openings up to 40 meters, and maybe 20 meters doesn't open too often. But I'm not an HF operator, so you have to bring me up to speed on that one, Mel. Back to you, Mel.
Roger. We've had a number of weeks go by where the basically solar count has been down to zero many days in a week, and cycle 24 has shown, I think, one spot because of the polarity they've been able to determine that it most likely will be attached to cycle 24. However, BCD dipole is actually, they call it a controlled current distribution dipole. And it gave me the information. I did go to look at it. It's being sold by this guy. He's making them up. And it's a full-wave dipole, and he puts a bunch of capacitors along the line. Actually, what he does is he made up a piece of plexiglass, and he cuts the wire, and in fact, he gives you quite a bit of information on it. He gives you not only the diagram, but he also gives you the technical information if you want to go ahead and make one yourself. And basically, he puts a bunch of little capacitors around 10 pf, all down at every so many feet along a full-wave dipole. And of course, it depends on what band you're operating on, how long it is, and how many he puts on there. And he claims it will work as effective as a regular dipole at very low height. In fact, he says a test they made, he puts a 40-meter or 80-meter dipole 10 feet above the ground and measured it against the dipole at, say, a quarter wave or better up, and he says no difference. And he says surrounding metal objects and things like that have very little effect on it, Dick, over.
Yeah, I'm kind of amazed by that because 10 picofarad at, say, for instance, 80 meters is, I'm doing a quick calculation right now, it's around 4,500 ohms of capacitor reactance. I'm amazed that something that high would work well. Without a doubt, as you add inductors into an antenna, you physically shrink the antenna because the inductors, you could say, are electronically making the antenna longer. Therefore, it's obvious that when you put on capacitors, you're electronically shrinking the antenna, forcing you to mechanically make it longer in order to reestablish resonance. If you take the capacitive coupling within the antenna to a far enough extreme, you could set things up in such a way that it becomes a 180-degree phase reversal at each individual capacitor, and then you would really be constructing a linear stacked collinear antenna. The superstation master type thing really is a bunch of half-wave dipoles stacked on top of each other in a rather similar manner. And yes, you get extra gain out of that broadside to the antenna. You start developing a pancake-like pattern. If you did this with a dipole parallel to the Earth, you would be developing a vertical pancake pattern. It would be quite sharp in azimuth, but unfortunately, only that energy that's going near the horizon is really useful to you. Some of it being that pancake is perpendicular to the ground, so therefore portions of it are straight up, portions of it are straight down. Now the portions that are straight up might help you with Nevis-like operations, near vertical incident skyways. So, fascinating antenna to experiment with. Do you know of a website that describes it or a particular article? Back to you, Mel.
I was able to get the information from him further. So I went to QRZ.com. It's advertising it on their website. And basically, They show pictures of it. He's got a bunch of little cut-up pieces of plastic. In fact, that's how he tells you to make it. Take a piece of plexiglass and make cut strips, and then cut them into smaller pieces, like an inch and a half or so long, and drill a hole on each side, and he gives you the formulation and everything, how to figure out how many you need along the line, and what the value of the capacitors are. And it looks like has like for I think 80 meters, had a dozen capacitors on each leg of the dipole or whatever. I don't remember. I just looked at it fairly quickly, and the capacitors. He tells you how to figure out the value of the capacitors. So he'll sell you the whole thing made up. He cuts up the plastic and drills the hole, puts the wires through, and solders the little capacitors across those points, you know, on the little piece of plexiglass, mounts it all up for you, and sells it. Making some very, very good claims about what it possibly it can do. I tell you the truth, I don't know much about it other than I've seen something like you also have seen relatable type of, design like that. But if you go to, like I say, QRZ.com, I saw it come up on the top there. They're advertising this CCD dipole deck. Over.
I'm looking at the QRZ website right now. I did a search on CCD and didn't find anything successful. You're saying it's up on top. Okay, I'm looking at the top of the QRZ.com website right now. I see things called forums. I see the ARRL letter, Ohio DX Bulletin, TeamSpeak software, and so on. All right, I'm going to look for the logos, the little bitty squares around the top. And so far, I'm not seeing CCD antenna rating quite like it. So, can you give me another hint as to how to get to that website where I could see a picture of it, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, it just so happens when I punched in QRZ.com, and it came up with flashing on top. It's one of those flash advertisements. You know, they always flash on some advertisement up on top selling some product, and it just has to flash on. I have to see it. It's set on. It's a CCD dipole, and when I, brought it up, went through the whole deal about how it works and everything, and, you know, the whole thing. It just has to flash on top, you know, where they have like a train of different commercial products that they handle, or I should say amateur radio products that they handle, Dick, over.
Okay, I see something called Cobra Ultralight multiband antenna. R&L Electronics is selling power supplies, and I don't see anything else flashing right now. So, right now it doesn't seem to be there, but I'll... When you've seen it, do you remember the actual logo, the actual URL itself, Mel? Go ahead.
So it came across like, you know, in a banner, and it said CCD dipole, and it just happened to be when I happened to, you know, bring up QRZ.com, I happened to see it on top. Normally, you know, you just most likely don't notice it. I may have been there before a number of times when I referred to something on QRZ.com, and it just happened that this time I saw it, and I guess this other person or some other people have seen it, and went to the once they brought it up, I guess they saw something of interest, because it seems that I think it's being sold directly. I think the person, I should have got more information at the time who it was, but I believe that it's being, he went in business, this gentleman, of making these dipoles up. It's maybe a new company, Dick, over.
Okay. No luck of me finding it right now. But go ahead with your questions or any other questions you'd like to from your email as well. Go ahead.
Thank you. Roger. Now, I've got one here from that person here. He lives in Staten Island. He says, I enjoy the TechNet very much, and unfortunately most of the time I can't get on at the right time to talk to you gentlemen directly and so on and so forth, but I want to commend you for the wonderful work that you're doing. I have a problem. I put up a 40-meter vertical. Did everything exactly to the book. Insulated properly from the ground and put a copper pipe around the bottom, 6-inch piece of copper that I had formed at a by a guy that does roofing, made me up a copper sleeve that went around the outside to connect the radios. I have 36 radios down full length, fanned out, and feeding it with the coax with a RG50 high quality RG8U that I bought from Radio Work. I go through a whole thing, you know. However, my problem is it loads properly and all on 40 meters, but for some reason I have a dipole up at about 35 feet. No matter where I talk to, whether it be local stations, DX stations, or whatever, they always say that the dipole going from A to B, that the dipole seems to always have, has so far been consistent, that the dipole has a stronger signal than my vertical. What am I doing wrong? I don't know how to answer this one, Dick. Go ahead.
Fascinating. Based on the assumption that caller, that writer, really doesn't have a shorted antenna, and you could tell that fairly fast by a reasonable amount of standing wave ratio measured in the shack. So assuming he's measuring a good standing wave ratio, that would strongly suggest that there is a 50-ohm load at the far end of that transmission line. And if that transmission line is going to his 40-meter dipole with 36 radials and a great big piece of copper in the ground, it sure sounds to me like that antenna is absorbing all the RF and radiating it into space. Now, the difference is that the vertical, of course, is radiating vertical polarization. The 30 feet above ground dipole is radiating primarily horizontal polarization. So for that particular period of time in which he ran these side-by-side tests, the particular people he was talking to, a function of their distance, the state of the ionosphere, the amount of Faraday rotation, and so on, but the horizontal people sounded stronger. Various times of the year, various times of the day, the magnetic field mixing with the ionosphere gives you a different amount of Faraday rotation. In other words, when a radio signal goes from your antenna out to space, hits the ionosphere, and gets reflected, I'm putting that word reflected in quotes, because it's more complicated than a simple reflection. But it gets through the ionosphere, comes back down to Earth. In many cases, not always, in many cases, a horizontally launched wave gets to your buddy's house in, we'll say, Pennsylvania. That's who you're having a QSO with. It arrives there vertically polarized. I question horizontally polarized, even though you launched vertical, and maybe vice versa. And when he sends a signal back to you, even if he sends a horizontal and you think, therefore, you're going to get a vertical, well, a Faraday rotation is one of the few things that does not obey reciprocity. If I've got 90 degrees of clockwise twist of the polarization of my signal when it goes from east to west, I might not get 90 degrees of counterclockwise rotation when it goes west from east. I may get some other number of degrees so that it doesn't repeat in general. So the possibility exists that that particular period of time that he did the test, a horizontal wave to those particular people he tested with just ended up with a stronger signal at their signal transmitter in their shack. And that if he does it at a different time of the year with different people, he may get a different answer. So before he condemns his 40-meter vertical antenna, I recommend he extend the experiment a little bit further. Talk to people further away. Talk to people different time of the day, different time of the year, and so on. The people who put up a well-engineered vertical antenna and 36 radials of the right length, properly connected, certainly sounds like that should work like a charm. Now, there's always the possibility you've got a short or an open in a coax or something else like that is really not letting very much of the signal get there, in which case 99% of the time your standing wave ratio meter will tell you that. There's also a slim possibility that that particular piece of coax that goes out to the vertical antenna was a piece of World War II coax that had been soaked under salt water for a while in somebody's basement, and that it has contaminating the polyvinyl chloride from the outer jacket contaminated the polyethylene on the inner jacket, and the cable is very lossy. Very, very unlikely, but just to be double darn sure, I would be tempted to turn on the transmitter of any known power, 1 watt, 10 watts, 100 watts, doesn't matter. Also put the watt meter in a dummy load at the far end of the coax where it connects to the 40-meter dipole, a 40-meter ground plane, and confirm that roughly the same number of watts gets there. If I launch 10 watts in the shack into that piece of RG8, and if at the other end into a dummy load and a good directional watt meter, I measure 9 watts getting there or 8.5 watts getting there, I would say that's pretty good. That's a 1 dB down from ideal, and so you can't blame it on the coax. So to be double darn sure, I would check the coax. After that, I can't think of anything better than to extend the experiment. And he may be an unlucky guy that the particular people he chose to talk to so far are the people who, for whatever reason, get a stronger signal when the power is only polarized when it's launched. That's the best I can come up with on this one, though. And keep checking as he continues the experiment, because, of course, it doesn't make sense, and it's got the curiosity of Mel and Dick running here. We'd like to find out what's going on. The scientists and us would like to know what's happening. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is what I did. This is K2KEY. I did question further on it through an email. There's a cable. I wasn't going to mention it, but it's a new, brand new LMR E4 cable that recently had delivered. The cable was installed when he put the vertical. They've made every kind of test that they could possibly think of. And this has been going on for a long period of time, over many dozens and dozens of contacts, day, morning, afternoon, whatever he's got a chance, always been an AD. Every contact he makes, whether it's been local DX stations, distance, within different distances, whatever he could possibly do, he says he has made the AB contact, AB comparison, it seems consistent that the dipole gets better report on the dipole. I asked him about how about receiving. He says, yeah, he says he even receives better on the dipole. They did to go ahead, he says, and had a friend come out there and made measurements, he says, and couldn't see any reason for it whatsoever, completely stumped him. And I asked him, what kind of instrument do you use? Well, they use the antenna smith, and did a full test series on it. In fact, even took a radio out to and connected it within a couple of feet of the dipole, measured the SWR again out there, and made contacts again, and with the radio right there at the base of the antenna, and he says it's consistent. He says, I just don't know where to go with this thing. It's an inch and a half pipe, one solid piece of pipe. He says, no joints or anything like that. And he says, guide with non-metallic guide. All purchased, all new, everything new. He thought this was going to be the epitome of a 40-meter antenna. And he says, so far, he says, I can't understand how come it just doesn't work no matter what we've tried. So I have, I just said to him it's a mystery to me, and that's why I will bring it up on the TechNet and see if we can in any way give them any idea where to go. I just think they sounds like they did everything that I possibly would think of off the top of my head, Dick, but I don't know. Is there certain places, maybe the soil conditions or whatever, or do something that you know, defy even 36 radials? Maybe put down more radials. I hesitate to say that because 36 radials is considerable. K2RIW in the group, K2KEY.
Okay, Rich recognized Mel, with 36 radials, he's already way beyond the point where the change has got to be small. As he goes from 36 radials to 360 radials, in theory, he should only make a rather small amount of change. If I put up a 40-meter vertical antenna, and if I chose a spot in Yonkers between those buildings, those 20-story-high buildings that are the projects, and they're, you know, shielding you on all sides, and I put a ground plane vertical 40-meter antenna on the lawn in the middle of that system, because you're in such a marble canyon, so to speak, I can see there how the vertical would behave rather poorly, and every bit of altitude is going to help, and the dipole with that extra altitude, I can't even say that. If the dipole is 36 feet high, and the 40-meter radial is by definition 32 feet long, 33 feet in that order. On a quick break, Mel, before we turn it over to Rich, does this person live in a metro area where he might be enclosed by a whole lot of tall buildings, or do you think he's in a very low-level area? What town do you think he's in, Mel? Go ahead.
That was one of my questions, and he told me he's in Staten Island up on the hill. He says he's got a big backyard and good 360-degree view in all directions. He says, I thought this was going to be the best amateur radio spot, he says, I could possibly find, he says, here in Staten Island. And yes, he says, it's fooled me already a couple of times. I didn't question any further what he meant by a couple of times, but it seems that in a location like that, where he says he's up on the hill there, he says near, well, he says, I guess maybe he didn't want to give out too much information about his exact location or whatever, but he says he's up on a place he says he'll be familiar with it as a high spot in Staten Island called Toad Hill, I believe. Yeah, Toad Hill, over.
That's one of the highest places on Staten Island. Just like he said, that should have a view out to the horizon that's out of sight. And maybe the answer here, Mel, is that his situation is so ideal that the dipole is behaving so well that nothing else can come close to it. Of course, that doesn't satisfy you or I. Maybe, Mel, you and I are going to have to visit him and see this antenna ourselves, bring our own bird watt meter, and at least see it with our own eyes. It defies common sense. But maybe Rich has got an answer. N2EO, go right ahead.
Yes, N2EO, I thought Mel said, maybe it wrong, that the guy made the antenna out of pipe. Is it possible somebody put Teflon tape or Permatex or some other type of insulating material on the threads between the sections? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's a slim possibility, but my impression of the pipe is that was in the ground as the ground and the vertical support, mechanical support for the antenna. Let's turn it back to Mel and find out. That's a copper pipe, and I think you said inch and a half, going into the ground. Is that a mechanical support? And since this is a commercially made antenna, I'm guessing the antenna itself is not made out of copper. Or maybe it is a home brew. Back to you, Mel, for some further words on that.
Yeah, I questioned all this. No, the pipe he's using is one chunk of pipe. It's a complete length of pipe, steel pipe, 33 feet long. And the piece of copper, he had a piece of, to put the radials to solder the radio, he had a piece of copper formed, a piece of flashing formed at a roofing place, and they just rolled it into a circle, an 8-inch circle, to, you know, sit in so that the insulated pipe, that the vertical section, sits in the middle of this on the insulator, which he told me it was a commercial insulator somebody sells for putting up vertical. And it loads, he says, perfect. Exactly. And they checked it with the antenna smith and everything. Everything he says, the person he says that he had to look at it supposedly is an expert, he says, on antennas. And he just stood there, he says, in complete amazement. He just shook his head. He says, I can't find nothing wrong with this. And until he says, I demonstrated, we did a couple demonstrations with a number of stations on 40 meters and back and forth, A, B, constantly, whatever way they did it, constantly, the dipole, not one person told them that the vertical was either equal or better, or, no, it was always less favorable with the vertical. So I don't know what to say, really, Dick. This is the one I could say really unusual. I mean, if he's given me the whole story like this, which I assume is correct, I have no answer, Dick, over.
Then, tonight at 8 o'clock.
I don't either, Mel. And when you and I get a little bit of spare time, we're going to have to visit him. It can't be like that. I guess there's a slim possibility that the AB switch itself has a failed switch position. And when you put the Biswas meter downrange of that point, you're bypassing the switch, so to speak, but the transmitter has to go through the switch. Not likely, but that seems to be the only thing left that didn't get tested. I mean, if you disconnect the piece of cable as it comes out of the transmitter and connect the Biswas meter there so that it's going through the AB switch, assuming there is one, it's always a slim possibility that the switch has got insertion loss on the A position, but on the B position it doesn't, so the dipole is being fed more power. Tis a mystery. Back to you, Mr. Anthony, the answer man. That was an old radio program way back in the 40s. Before your time, Mel, you probably haven't heard about the answer man. K2KEY, K2RIW in the tech net.
Hey, Roger, this is K2KEY. That's right, you're the old guy by about, what, 6 weeks, I think. No, that's why they went out to the antenna itself, and they disconnected the cable, and they put the radio, right out there in the backyard with a shorter cable, piece of cable, right to the vertical. In other words, eliminated the whole cable going to the shack, the AB switch, the whole deal, and just operated right from the point in the outside. And had a number of, I don't know, they had a number of people that they recontacted that were cooperating. I'll tell you one thing, there's a lot of people on, I noticed, on 80 and 40 meters that love to do antenna tests with you. I guess they're all looking for the panacea of the fantastic antenna, you know, that you'll come up with something and they'll say, how do you do it, you know? Because I noticed there's a lot of that AB business going on in both 80 and 40 meters. Dick, but they did the same test, like I say, they eliminated everything, they went right out to the antenna site, and they did it, it confirmed that, you know, that it wasn't the feed line or anything else, because they eliminated all that, so, I guess, we'll eventually know the end to this mystery. I have no idea. You want to hear another one? Over.
Sure do, go right ahead.
Okay, person says, again with 40 meter dipole. I can say right now the band that is of interest on HF is 40 meters, really. It's been quite good at times, amazingly good at times, considering what overall conditions are like. I want to put up a half wave 40 meter dipole. Can I feed it with 70-ohm hard line? You keep talking about hard line. I got myself a whole load of hard line, thanks to Dick suggesting I speak to a place that has a lot of hard line, and they have a lot of it laying around. And I took more than I can possibly use, and I'd like to make use of it. And how do I go about hooking a 70-ohm hard line and put up a 40-meter dipole and use it? Can I do this? Well, besides the mechanical situation, I guess, how the heck do you, I guess, how you, can you, you know, join, how to join the hard line directly to the center of a 40-meter dipole? Have you done any of these, something unusual with this, Dick? Over.
Now, the 70-ohm hard line, if you wanted to buy equal quality cable from the Andrew catalog, you're going to pay some number of dollars per foot when you buy the cable. And the 70-ohm hard line that's at these depots or warehouses or whatever, stockyards, the cable television stockyard usually has quite a few feet of the stuff, quite a few hundreds of feet of the stuff. And laying on the reel, at the end of the reel, and they don't want to use it, they don't want to put any splices. And if you're real smart, you don't even have to unreel it. You can take the four bolts apart that hold the wooden reel together and take the reel apart. I've done that. You end up with a very nice coil of hardline in your hand. And the hardline is a beautiful, extremely low-loss cable, up to 1296 megacycles. It's designed for frequencies that high. To use hardline on 80 meters is not bad. It's just using dynamite to kill a fly, so to speak. RG8 on 40 meters usually is adequate. You don't need super low loss on 40 meters. But if you want to do it, and the price is right, go to it. It's got to work. The only slight disadvantage of hardline is putting connectors on the end of it is a bit difficult. The Stinger connector that the cable company uses to interface between the half-inch, three-quarter-inch, seven-eighths, inch-and-a-quarter, whatever, to interface between their hardline and the utility boxes that they have the amplifiers contained in, that connector is called a Stinger connector. It does a beautiful job of mating with the hardline itself. It's got a 5/8, 24 thread on the outside, and it's got a long center conductor, which you can cut to the right length, solder on the center pin of your type N connector, and as long as you have the right model number of type N connector, I call it a UG-21, but there's a problem. UG-21 is a military designation for a type of kind of type N connector, UG-21 Baker, UG-21 Golf, UG-21 Delta. Unfortunately, the mil-spec definition of those connectors has been dropped, and therefore a manufacturer will manufacture one particular type of UG-21 connector. They'll stamp some of them A, stamp some of them UG-21B, some of them UG-21C. No matter what you order, you get the exact same connector, but it has the model number that you asked for stamped onto it. And although that doesn't sound like an ethical thing to do, it is legal now that that connector no longer is clearly defined by the original military specification, M3900 something or other with a bunch of dash numbers. So you got to make sure you get the right version of type N male connector, where the nut on the back of the connector is also a 5/8, 24 thread, in which case you simply take the shell of the type N connector, UG-21 Baker will say, and screw it on to the end of the Stinger. And installing the Stinger connector, if you want to be a purist, you buy the tool, which is a fancy tool that does a good job of coring out the foam. You have to remove some of the foam from the end of the cable down about an inch or so, maybe 3/4 of an inch, so that the connector can properly mate with the cable. A crafty amateur with a good Swiss Army knife can easily do that himself. It'll look a little bit homely, but until you get up to 1,000 megacycles, the RF will never see the difference of your homely job of whittling out the foam with your Swiss Army knife as opposed to doing it with the fancy coring tool. So while you're at that stockyard,